Welcome back to Campbell Conversations with your host, Colin Campbell. And today is episode 201 of the podcast. And I'm delighted to be joined in conversation by Dan Ashburn. Dan is an Amazon entrepreneur and the co-founder of the Titan Network. With over a decade of experience in e-commerce and digital marketing, Dan is an expert in growing brands on Amazon, guiding them from zero to eight figures and even nine figures on the platform. And he has an incredible entrepreneurial mindset that we're going to get into today. You can expect to learn about Dan's first foray into making money online in his early teens, how his family life led to him having to grow up fast and join the RAF, the skills he built during his time in the military, and his early entry into the world of Amazon. Amazon has evolved a lot over the years, and Dan has grown and succeeded in this space throughout that time. And during the next 60 minutes, you're going to get a real insight into the mindset, advice, insights, lessons, and the views of a thoroughbred entrepreneur who's achieved at the very top level. I want to say a huge thank you for the number of you who reached out and messaged me after hitting the milestone of 200 episodes last week. The response to the episode with Andrew Craig and him coming back on the podcast has been incredible. I've been seeing that in the downloads, in the new subscribers, and of course in the ratings that have been left on Spotify and Apple Podcasts. If you haven't had the time to do so yet, please make sure you are subscribed on whatever platform you're listening on. And if you are using Apple Podcasts or Spotify, hit that 5-star rating button. I have so many incredible guests coming. Dan is just one of those. So please do keep sharing the episodes with friends, family, colleagues, whoever will benefit from the episode. Please do pass it on to them. We are growing at a rate of knots, and it cannot keep happening unless you take the action to share it with the other person that you think would benefit too. It really is the funny little way that audio podcasts grow. One other thing to mention before we dive into this 60-minute episode with Dan Ashburn is please make sure you're on my email list. I've had a number of challenges on Instagram. There's actually an impersonation account that's got a zero at the end of the username rather than an O that I've got, and it's messaging people about trading and investing in crypto with them. So please do watch out for that. And unlike Instagram, I can have a lot more control over my email list and a lot more control of the content that goes out on there and gets seen on there. So please do make sure you're joining that. It's a MailChimp link that is in the show notes. But that's quite enough from me during this introduction. You're going to hear the music, and you can hear from myself and Mr. Dan Ashburn. Dan, welcome to the show. Thank you for joining me.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Colin.
And when I was getting prepared for this one, I was really researching the world of Amazon entrepreneurship and some of the huge figures and sums that are involved. But for me, I want to go back way before that. And I've heard you describe yourself before in your teens as a bit of a closet geek. Why was that?
I think it was kind of the boom of the internet just kicking out. Most of my friends were kind of out playing football. And while they were doing that, I just had this mad obsession with the internet, computers, technology. And it was at a time where all of that was kind of emerging, and I just had infinite ideas for how you could reach people, connect with people via the internet. But then also this technology that quite clearly was revolutionizing the world at the time and really coming in a big way. My old man, my dad, ran a small business, an industrial business. He just had a bunch fitted. I was just obsessed. At that age, just completely obsessed.
What kind of websites were you building then?
Back then, it was blogs, kind of information websites, ebooks, anything really that I could rank in Google. So I had this obsession with Google was in its early days of kind of providing the search system that it does today. And back then, it was far simpler, but you could get a website to show up at the top of those results very quickly. If you knew what you were doing, and millions of people potentially would then come across that site, and that's a lot of influence that you can drive. So it was anything that I could rank at the top of Google, and then I'd get a lot of friends asking me, people from my dad's circle asking me, hey, that's that kid that can build a website and he can get it show up on Google. And this was the early days of kind of SEO helping businesses kind of generate business, I guess.
How quickly was it something that was like a fiscal passion? Because clearly you're speaking there like turning down the games of football with your friends down the park to build this. But how quickly was it something you were like, oh, well, maybe I can make money from this?
I went through this crazy journey. It was kind of like it started out as a hobby, and I have early memories, maybe 10 or 11, of my mum showing me how to type and kind of get on. I think it was Windows 95 back then. So it went from this kind of hobby to almost an obsession and fairly kind of unhealthy. And I tend to get like that. I'm kind of, once I get into something, I'm in it and I have to figure it out, which I definitely think has helped serve me today and get me to where I am today. But it went from this hobby to this obsession to then a passion. And I think that kind of took place over maybe 4 or 5 years in my teens, testing a bunch of stuff, failing at a bunch of stuff. And I'm really, I think it was those failures that allowed me to progress so quickly in my skill and my art. Because out of every failure, there was a lesson, and then you'd apply that lesson to the next attempt and go from there.
What were some of the early lessons that maybe stick with you now when we look at what you're doing?
Early lessons, I mean, the internet, I mean, it's the whole thing, the whole game has changed a lot, but I'd say universally, understand a rough idea of what you're trying to get out of something that you're going into, so that you're not zigzagging and kind of look back 12, 18 months and you're in the exact same position, but you understand exactly where you're trying to get to. And spend a bit of time kind of really doing the thinking before you do the work on what's the best way of getting there, what's the path of least resistance, what's the most efficient way I can achieve that result. Now, I went through a bunch of stuff with payment providers like PayPal and all this stuff, which has all been largely regulated today, but effectively kind of know what you're getting into, understand the game, and then spend a bit of time thinking about how to play that best game.
And back then it was a bit more of a wild west with things like PayPal or other payment providers. What were some of the maybe the failures that stand out from that regard?
Yeah, I remember being about, I think I was about 13 or 14. And I had registered a company, a UK company, I think it was called Spiderweb Limited or something. And I'd set it all up. We'd got PayPal as a payment provider, and I'd written a really successful ebook on SEO. So how to rank websites in Google, how to get them to show up high in the search results. And I think the exact number, I can't remember. I think I'd sold 10, 15 grand's worth of this ebook. And I was really excited about it. And I was kind of showing off to my family, like, hey, look, I just made a bunch of money. And then PayPal record it all. Because it was against their terms of service or something in the way in which that was being sold. It was a high risk item or something. I ended up in a bunch of trouble with PayPal and payment plans and stuff like that, because they'd refunded the customers. And I think it was only about £2,000 or £3,000 in the end. But it was definitely kind of one of those, okay, this is real.
Well, at that age, I think £2,000 or £3,000 is a notable sum of money. You'd be the talk of the school with the clothes you'd be wearing or the items you'd be able to have access to when you're turning over that kind of stuff. But I find it really interesting that straight away there was the website passion, but of course you were almost selling your expertise in terms of, look, I've written this ebook on SEO, and as a young guy, I've kind of not cracked the code. That sounds a bit glib, and maybe that's part of the marketing. But you have a good understanding of how this works. So straight away, it's become something that you can monetize and sell your wisdom onto others who maybe want to get to point B or point C or point D in the alphabet, if we're using that from A. And you're able to do that because you've already got a bit more knowledge than they do.
Yeah, sure. I think it largely came out of, most of it was service-based. So I'd get a lot of asks of local businesses, family, friends, etc. Hey, can you help me with your website? Hey, can you sort out something physical like my internet router? So I was doing a lot of just helping people. And then I found that converting that knowledge, especially around the SEO stuff, into an ebook or some sort of written form really helped me hone my skill. And it's something I've definitely taken kind of through my life and through my journey is helping others achieve success. You really have to have refined and mastered a framework to deliver that success that's predictable, that's repeatable, similar to the fitness space, I guess. And to get to that level, you've really got to answer all of the fuzzy questions. So even today, when I produce training for our members in Titan, it's a very clarifying process, because even with brand new concepts or strategies that we're testing into tens of millions of dollars, it might work once, but then you've got to repeat that result over and over again in different categories across different products, and attempt to break that down into a framework that is, one, easy to understand, easy to follow, is predictable, repeatable, generates the target result. And that process, that specific process, is something I've definitely learned to love.
I think you find a lot of the time the mark of a charlatan online is somebody that can say about their achievements that they've done, but they can't show or explain how they've gotten there. And one of the kind of themes of the podcast over the last few years, I've definitely noticed, is that you become much more able to articulate your thoughts and your processes and the steps you can take. And it just reinforces the lesson for you over and over again. So I guess if we go back to Young Dan writing that ebook on SEO, when you're writing these frameworks down and these different steps down, it's just reinforcing the lesson of what you need to do next time you build a website as well. So there is merit in mapping out your thoughts and your processes. And it just kind of, I'm sure there's some sort of neuro-linguistic science to that where it's reinforcing different pathways or something like that. But there's definitely a magic in being able to articulate and speak that. And like you said, even from a fitness perspective, if somebody's explaining how they particularly achieve a particular result, it's just reinforcing what they need to do next time around. They want to achieve something similar too.
Yeah, for sure. I'm a big believer in success lies in the last 10% of effort. But to get to that 10%, you have to complete 90% of the work first. And I find that taking achievements or taking a way of working or a certain approach to deliver a result and documenting it forces you to really get to that last 10% and articulate it. And I think for anyone who's really mastering a craft or a certain skill, that's really where the magic happens for sure.
Yeah, if you were doing these websites at such a young age, then what happened in between? Because I know you went away and joined the Air Force as well. So talk us through the kind of teenage years and what started to shape you.
Yeah, sure. So my parents divorced early. I think I was 11 or 12. And long story short, I ended up moving out to the Canary Islands, Spain, which was a playground for mischief out there. Like you've got a party island in the summer, lots of bars, lots of clubs, tourists coming in. So I was attempting to go to school out there. I think I completed two GCSEs. It was a private sort of British international kind of setup. But then also was a teenager living in a somewhat European party island. So that took me down one path for sure. On the side was still definitely big into all of this online stuff. Thinking back, I was running web hosting servers, I was selling gaming servers, I was doing all this kind of infrastructure stuff on the internet, but found myself in this place where all these distractions kicked in and I definitely enjoyed them at an early age. So come, I think I was about 15, yeah, maybe just coming up 16, mum kind of had enough of it and said, hey, you need to go back to the UK and kind of reset. So came back to the UK, was in an apartment here in the UK at that age, kind of fending for myself, was working in a local bar, running the cocktail bar, convincing them that it's fine that I'm not 18. And I woke up one morning after a year of really just kind of wandering through life, not really kind of going anywhere, still doing a bunch of stuff online, helping local businesses, websites, etc. And I heard an advert on the radio that the Air Force was looking for skilled IT people. So I thought to myself, well, I'm pretty good at IT, evidently. I walked into the careers office that day and 2 weeks later I was in basic training.
That is it's so interesting nowadays, because if you were to be 17-year-old Dan now, the chance of you hearing an advert on the radio for the military are probably a lot more slim, because we're all plugged into our own music, our own podcasts, whatever else when we're driving as well. But it's funny how sometimes these things happen at the right time. And I've had a lot of different veterans on the podcast from people in the commandos and the SAS, the SBS, all that kind of stuff as well. And while we're not maybe going to delve into like different missions that you were part of from an IT perspective, but it's really interesting how the military can offer a level of guidance and structure to a young man that perhaps needs it at that point. Because look at all the stuff you've gone on to do. There's a level of capability that was being demonstrated from like 13 building these websites. But if you're, and this is not to be disparaging to people who work behind a bar full time, but you were clearly capable of far more than that. And it's interesting that that was the vehicle that you chose at that point in time. So what kind of stuff were you getting up to within the military, within the Air Force?
Yeah, I moved around quite a bit, but I think just to the point on it shaping you, I'm grateful for every single experience. Like my teens in sort of Tenerife definitely got it out of my system early. It could have sent me down the wrong track completely, but I got it out of my system early. Then when I was working that bar, kind of making ends meet for a couple of years, not even 18, that really forced me to grow up and understand what it means to kind of fend for yourself. And being in that environment, hospitality, meeting people, talking to people, having to show up there helped. And then, yeah, the military, it absolutely shaped me. It turned me from a boy to a man. I turned up kind of a bit arrogant, I guess, a bit uncontrollable, not really knowing what I was doing. And I come out of basic training and then into second stage training for a year. And it taught me everything I am today: leadership, structure, management, discipline, everything that's really kind of created the foundation for my life today. In terms of what I was doing, it started out as just general IT support. Then it went on to communications work. I was working up at RAF Coningsby, which is a base that holds a lot of the UK rapid response defence. So I was working on the typhoons up there and the supporting that kind of infrastructure. And then I was out in the Middle East working with the Americans, doing bits out there as well.
Exciting. And I think it's always intriguing for me with all the different people I get to speak to on the show when they look back at their childhood. And some of it, I can always accuse people of post-op rationalizing, but it's great that you're recognizing all these different phases and what they contributed towards. So from the hospitality trade, I was learning how to talk to people. I was growing up, I couldn't just be a kid anymore. Especially, I mean, living yourself at that age as well is probably something that has a big impact as well, because you really is sink or swim at that point in terms of can I look after myself, can I wash my clothes, can I cook my meals. But it's intriguing, all these different stages and how they, like, almost like layers of paint,
yeah,
to build up the picture that we see now. And too many people sometimes don't think, what did I take from that particular experience that I can move forward with? And particularly one of the phrases you used was almost like living on autopilot for that,
yeah,
period of time. But thankfully there's lessons from that period of time that weren't entirely wasted on you, because my real fear for so many people in society nowadays is that we are just on autopilot, because we're constantly distracted by short-term pleasures from our phone, Deliveroo delivered straight to the door, working from home sometimes, and it means that you become a bit of a recluse as well. So life is so easy to be just on autopilot and coasting. And so when we're kind of breaking that convention with conversations like this one, it's something I'm a big fan of.
Yeah, for sure. I'm something I often think about is, it's an analogy called the small hinges. So if you think back over your journey from early memories through your teens into early adulthood, and then look at where you are today, generally there are maybe three or four pinnacle moments that you can pinpoint that accelerated or changed the path that you were on. So for me, it was moving to Tenerife, coming back from Tenerife, making that decision to join the Air Force, and then later, as I'm sure we'll get to, making the decision to leave the Air Force, and then meeting a couple of key individuals. I can see in my journey exactly what put me here today, but it's not that did it to me or for me. It was me that was constantly realizing I'm on autopilot or I'm comfortable and deciding to make change. And it's crazy. I sit here, I'm in the UK today. I've just spent 3 years living out in Dubai, and I'm here for the very same reason. I was on autopilot in Dubai. I was very comfortable living this really nice life. But I've got stuff I want to do, and I'm pushing. And I change your state, change your environment type mentality. And I'm just a big believer in, if you kind of look around and you're not happy with your environment, or you're on autopilot, or you're just a bit too comfortable and you're not where you want to be, then you have to push. You have to push through that, and you have to kind of change state, change your environment, and generate a result.
It can breed complacency, and I guess that's something that you must have noticed straight away, like kind of fast forwarding to staying in Dubai and some of the businesses you've been involved in and some of the massive achievements that you've got. It's great that you've recognized that, right, okay, maybe this is just coasting autopilot mode. And that's when you can tell from the decisions you've made and these small hinges that you're talking about, yeah, that's when you're like, fuck no, I'm not staying in this place of comfort. That's amazing to recognize. When it comes to your time in the military then, you mentioned it gave you structure around leadership and insight around that kind of thing. What else did you learn that you kind of took forward before it was time to leave?
I learned resilience, persistence, and I believe I often get asked kind of what are the characteristics of success in an individual. I don't believe it's background or environment or anything like that. Don't get me wrong, those things help. But I think the true characteristics that drive success in anyone is their ability to be persistent, to be resilient, and to keep on kind of driving. And I think they're the two main characteristics that the military installed in me, is no matter the environment, no matter the pressure, you've got a mission, you've got an objective, you understand what the goal is, you wake up every day and you're persistent and resilient to achieve that, no giving up. Now, don't get me wrong, we all have bad days and we all question things, but it's that ability to pick yourself up off the floor or under extreme pressure when things get tough, ask yourself, how can I get through this? How can I achieve this? And it's interesting when you start asking your brain, how can you achieve something? The various paths that come through. And then finally, I think it'd be courage to actually do that. I've been in bouts of crippling stress where I'm like, anxiety's kicking in, I'm shaking. And my wife, Lottie, who's kind of been with me this whole journey, we met at 11 in school. She'll put me back together and kind of push me through. And it's having that resilience, persistence, and courage to stick at it, for sure. And I think I'm most grateful for that, for my experience in the military.
That's a number of huge qualities that is like almost lacking in today's environment as well. So for you to carry those forward, it means you're much more in a position to win. And I think so many self-development podcasts are quoting Alex Hormozi at the moment, but he was talking about it's almost never been easier to win because society has become quite soft and quite weak and almost embracing that. Whereas if you can be a little bit more savage and a little bit more courageous, a little bit more resilient, a little bit more persistent, it puts you in the top however many percentile of people. And I mean, look at what you've achieved. But all that time in the military, good levels of lessons to take away, great insights to move forward with. What was the tipping point to say, I want to move away from this? Because were you still involved with some of the different IT stuff that you were doing on the side?
Yeah, for sure. So I was still doing a lot of SEO, selling web hosting, websites. I had monetized sites at that point as well, just like blog sites that would then drop Google advertising on and you pick up the royalties off the advertising. I was messing around with early YouTube. So I was doing all this stuff on the side from my dorm, fairly kind of automated. And I was at this kind of crossroads. I'd really liked the idea of going down the route of like reconnaissance and down the commission route. And at the time, I kind of found myself working in a special team that was involved in the UK defence infrastructure. And I was kind of working above my rank at that point anyway. I was reporting directly to the Flight Louis of my division, which at my rank wasn't normal. You'd have a few ranks between you. His name was Brad, actually. And he could see what I was doing, and he was really good with me. He would, as long as I got my kind of pieces done, which I always would, I'd sit there and I'd be in the office and like over lunch or whatever, I'd have my laptop out and I'd be doing stuff. And I said to him, hey, I want to go down like the commission route, or I want to go down like a more elevated route. And he was coaching, supporting me through the application process of all that stuff. And he sat me down one day and he said to me, he goes, Dan, you've been at this, I think I was four years or so. You've been at this four and a half years now. Your ambition quite clearly outweighs the military, the mod, as it's called. I think you should seriously consider pursuing your passion. And whilst, I mean, with military officer hat on, Brad would likely should have, if he was following the rules, going, yes, you should become a commissioned officer, yes, you should go down this route, he saw in me what maybe I didn't see in myself, and he kind of gave me the confidence to do it. So from that point forward, fast-tracked through leaving the military. I already had a company on the side of my military day job. So I literally just wrote a letter of acceptance of a job from my company to myself to fast track the process. And yeah, 6 months later, I was kind of out. But it was him and then my Sergeant Charlie that really kind of gave me that confidence at, what was I, 22? Yeah, 22, I think, to kind of make that leap of faith. Lottie and I had now got quite serious. I left and off I went onto my kind of entrepreneurial journey.
Really interesting that people recognized where your passions lay, and while the capability to progress within the military was there, they could quite obviously see there was maybe a shelf life to it or an expiry date. And there's always an expiry date to any particular career or business. And you see that with lots of different entrepreneurs. And I'm sure Titan is something at the moment, but there'll maybe be something in 5 years' time that Dan Ashburn turns his hand to instead. But I certainly think that if people recognize that, imagine how good you could be if you turned your hand full time to this passion.
Yeah.
They can see quite what you're capable of. So I think to kind of break the wall with the listeners, having something that you're building on the side that one day can tip over is always an exciting prospect. And I think it's something that a lot of people should always consider, particularly in this environment now where we've got people talking about cost of living. We've got employers very much potentially looking to downsize or change, particularly in tech. If we're staying on that subject, like there's been huge changes. We've got AI coming down the tracks as well in terms of what does that mean for certain jobs in the future as well. So providing yourself with the opportunity to make some sort of fiscal income or at least some sort of base from your passion is quite an exciting thing. And it's great to see that during this time in the military, even if you were perhaps tested and given different opportunities and things, you still were making time because of your capability to do the things that kind of gave you the platform to leave and move forward quickly.
Yeah, I think so. And I think it comes back to that obsession and passion. For anyone that is serious about creating change in their life and achieving something of success that they've created that maybe provides a certain lifestyle or kind of structure for life that they desire, you have to show up and you have to be obsessive about making it happen. I've coached and helped thousands of entrepreneurs. I've made hundreds of millionaires at this point, or helped create hundreds of millionaires at this point over my journey. And if I kind of look at the trends or the characteristics of the individuals that succeed, it's those that get obsessive about succeeding and about the thing, whatever the vehicle is, whether it's Amazon or some other vehicle, they get obsessive about mastering it. And another thing as well is putting yourself in an environment where you're surrounded by people who do and have the ability and the awareness to see that in you. Now, I felt lucky in the environment I was in with Charlie and Brad. I was very, very fortunate to have them as kind of mentors and seniors to me at such an early age, and that they kind of gave me that confidence. But I think in today's world, there are so many communities and so many circles that you can put yourself in, regardless of what your day job is, in an environment you aspire to be in. And it honestly fast tracks the process. And you've got that cliche saying of you kind of the equal of the five people around you. But it's so true. It's so true. So if you're surrounding yourself with maybe friends from school that are good lifelong friends, but they're things about living for the weekend and getting out on a Friday night, being hungover Saturday, Sunday, and then doing it over again. And your thing is, well, actually, I'm trying to, in the next 3 years, I want to be kind of physically independent or location independent. I want to be earning a certain amount of money, and I want to have some notoriety, or just whatever your goal is, go find the people and the community that's doing that. And I think I learned that through those guys, not necessarily that they were doing what I was doing, but they were definitely people that lifted me up and empowered me in that position, I guess.
Yeah, exactly that. And I like spending time with people who maybe have excellence in another field I'll never relate to. So the gentleman that connected us is Chris Burns, who's a phenomenal copywriter. Now, while I don't have aspirations to be a copywriter, I can learn lots from how he's grown his business massively over the last 3 years, how he's worked in his personal development, how he's worked on his relationships and his mindset and his health and his fitness. That's fantastic, because there's people that they're playing a similar game, but just in a slightly different league or in a different domain from you, and you can recognize the attributes that they've got. And in the same way that the senior chaps that you were dealing with in the military, they were probably excellent at what they were doing, and they could recognize that you have a level of excellence that could be applied elsewhere. But we've mentioned the word Amazon throughout the podcast already. But when you left the military, Amazon, was it a thing at you at the age of 22 for you?
No, it wasn't actually. So I went through a series of businesses. The first was a local marketing agency. So I left the military. I think the press release at the time was like Afghan to businessman or something like that. It was a spin on it. And I went from my back bedroom to my mother-in-law's garage to offices in Birmingham city centre in a couple of locations. And it was just hustle for a year. At the time, my best friend John was managing a call centre. He was also early early 20s. And I said, John, trust me, phone the accountant. So I got hold of my dad's accountant and registered this company. We're starting a business. He knew nothing about what I did. And I said to him, give me 6 months and I'll build this thing up to a point where you can come on board full time and we're going to go and build this digital marketing agency. And this wasn't like what you see today. This was like we were early days digital marketing agency. So next day I get a knock on the door. John's at my door at my one bed apartment. And he said, screw it, we're in. And he quit his job there and then, literally the next day. And then we just hustled like crazy for 6 months on the phone. I was running a local B&I chapter at 23, at 5 o'clock or 6 o'clock in the morning, whatever those breakfast meetings are, going to everything I could do, messaging. And yeah, we built just shy of a 7-figure business in about a year, just through pure grit effectively. So that was the first.
What were the main services you were offering from a digital marketing perspective back then?
It was websites, Google AdWords, SEO, early days Facebook ads, some basic social media. It was just general local business marketing, Google Maps optimization, but it expanded across fields. And in that time, we had a few hundred clients across various different kind of services. We built and deployed 600-700 websites. We were actively running 200-300 SEO campaigns. We were deploying hundreds of thousands, if not into the millions, in Google ad spend. One of the big successes we had is a local jeweler's, who was a family jeweler, actually made this ring. He had come to me and said, Dan, I heard you know about the internet. I want to start selling gold. So for those that don't know, you can buy physical gold and silver online. It's a huge kind of commodity trading market. And the local jewelers wanted to get involved in selling it. It's a volume game, small margin, but big volume. So we hacked together this website using Magento. It had to live update off the stock market. And using kind of early days Google, we managed to build that business up to the second or third largest bullion dealer in the UK. And he actually heard me on a podcast, I think it was last year, and he dropped me a text saying, you can tell your listeners that website did 100 million last year. So yeah, that was our early days success. But John and I would get up at like 3 o'clock in the morning because the feed to the price of gold would break. And we would literally just like nurture this thing like a small animal. And we just kind of sit there 24 hours a day trying to keep this thing alive. So it's less.
There's the passion and the obsession there, Dan.
Yeah, I think so. So, and it's lessons and experience like that compound into generating a result. I think so many people see success today on the internet and think it's generated like click of a button. But I think what people have to understand and appreciate is all the pain and the experience that went into generating that result. And don't get me wrong, people do get obviously lucky, but sustained success does takes lessons.
Undoubtedly. I think particularly with e-commerce, which we'll go on to speak about, there was that boom during 2020-2021 where a lot of people turned their hand to it and suddenly saw massive success just because of the nature of more money being pumped into the system that was not being able to be spent by going out and about due to the C-19 policies. And then when it's come to the actual crunch where you've got a cost of living and people are perhaps being slightly more frugal with their money, they've kind of fallen off and they've wondered, oh, this e-com thing doesn't work. And you're thinking, well, it worked for you 6 months ago when you maybe were striking lucky. But I agree, sustained success is something that you're definitely able to speak about. So when did Amazon become part of your world?
Yeah, sure. So we did that bit. We did all that work with the jewelers, and then we got introduced to a local dentist who was best in the country at Invisalign, the teeth straightening products, the clear teeth braces. So Sandeep, we established the UK's first Invisalign practice, then went on to establish the My Smile Network, which today is UK, if not Europe's largest provider of Invisalign. That was a huge undertaking because we had to take a centralized budget and make consultations show up in a local area, generally a 5-mile radius of a practice, for a £5,000 product or a £3,000 product today. So that was a whole undertaking, and that taught us a bunch. And we ended up kind of running marketing for the Invisalign product for a few years. And then along that journey, I got an email talking about Amazon. Now, I knew a bit about Amazon at the time, so I'd helped a local garden center connect their e-commerce store to Amazon to sell their products. But I didn't know, I think like many of us back then, that the average person could sell on Amazon. I thought that was eBay and that was all these other platforms. Amazon was kind of the big box retailers or Amazon themselves. So I looked at it, and at that time, to be honest, I was feeling quite burnt out. I'd become kind of a slave to my own business. And I think there's probably many business owners that maybe listen to your podcast here, Colin, that have that feeling of being a slave to their clients, a slave to their business. They maybe aren't a business owner. They're more like a, have a job in the inside of their own.
They're self-employed. Yeah. There's a big difference between a business owner and self-employed. And almost one of the terms that a couple of guests have used is almost golden handcuffs, yeah. Because fiscally it's very, very fulfilling and it's ticking the right boxes. But you are handcuffed to it in terms of your time and your energy to an extent that isn't as healthy as you would want it to be.
Yeah, for sure. So we're in this position. We were actually over in the custard factory in Birmingham. We had a local relationship with the Birmingham University. So I had interns coming through. We'd built up a team at this point. So we had staff and everything going on. But I kept saying to John, like, there's got to be something that's easier to operate. So when I think about how to make money, I kind of use the analogy that you've got the economic engine, the thing that generates the value that creates the money. And then you've got the vehicle that carries that engine. So in my former business, the economic engine was the highly skilled kind of services that me and my team delivered that produced the value of more business for our clients. But the vehicle in which that delivered was complex, high touch, hundreds of clients, lots of busy work, lots of communication. So it was, economic engine was powerful, but it was also a very complicated vehicle to kind of operate. So I said, okay, let's find something better. And this email dropped in my inbox and it kind of talked about the notion that you could create products and sell them on Amazon. And this wasn't reselling. It wasn't wholesaling. It wasn't going to a thrift shop or a charity shop and buying something cheap and just arbitraging it and selling it for more. It talked about the ability to own the product you're selling. Therefore, no one else can sell it and you get all of the sales. So I looked at John and we were having a bit of a slump at the time, actually, in the business, because we had all these staff. And that was another lesson about kind of the economics and the ratios of like payroll versus revenue and the kind of efficiencies of a business, because we'd gone from being just us to being this team and office and overhead. And we kind of grown up in that scale as well. So we're at this point where we're at a slump in business a little bit. Costs have kind of sneaked in. And I said, I think there's something in this. So I looked into it and they were talking about an event out in Vegas. Now, I'd never traveled internationally for business. I'd obviously been away with the military and been on holidays and that sort of stuff, but never really away to like a conference. And I looked at John and I said, right, it's $4,000 or $5,000 for the course. It's going to cost me another $4,000 or $5,000 to get over to Vegas. I'm going to go on my own. I was 23 or something, 24 at the time. Trust me, this is going to work. So he looked at me and went, okay. And a month later, I was over in Vegas at this conference.
John's got a lot of trust in you, Dan. He really backs you.
Yeah. John's my boy. I've got a couple of people like that around me. I wouldn't be where I am today if it wasn't for people like John, Lottie, Lydon, and those at the Athena, and those that have supported me kind of the entire way, for sure.
Yeah, that's great to recognize. What were you learning on this course then that opened up this whole new world to you?
It was a friend. It was a guy that had really figured out kind of this whole private label world. And to be honest, he's largely responsible for the entire movement of this industry. He was one of the first to really figure it out at scale. And it was the notion that you could look at the data that Amazon presents. So as an average consumer, you go on Amazon, you search for a product you want to buy, a silicone spatula. And then there's certain data points available that allow you to kind of figure out how many units that product is selling. And then you do the math, you go to Alibaba, you'd figure out what you could buy it for. And providing there was enough margin, the kind of key to success with it all is you would design your own brand, have the manufacturer or the factory print your brand on that product, and then you'd register that brand with Amazon in today's world. Therefore, no one else can sell that brand. So you're not competing on price. There's not 100 other sellers selling the same product. You own it. And then it's simply a case of rinse and repeat. So these products on average, gross margin on average, somewhere around 30%, net margin 20%, depending on how efficient you are with your advertising. And it's like a cash machine, isn't it? How many dollars can you put in and how many dollars are you generating out? And then you get into the cash flow of, well, how many dollars can I raise to put into this thing? It was an exciting time.
Yeah, that's intriguing. What were some of those first products then that you turned your hand to? You mentioned the silicone spatula there.
Yeah, no, I silicone spatula wasn't early on, actually. We do run a silicone spatula. We do about $6 million a year in silicone spatulas. My first product, the first product we sold was a puppy, I don't know how you say it, a puppy Wii mat or pee pad, you know, the dog training mats. which was definitely entertaining after a few beers in the office and all the and the team and sort of throwing water around and stuff. Like, yeah, so it was puppy training pads were the first product. And even that was an experience in itself, because you have to really get to that first principle thinking of, well, what is it that delivers value in this product? Because Amazon's a review driven platform. Like, you live and die by your reviews. You have to produce a quality product. And nowadays you have to differentiate that product as well. You have to find a way of standing out in the market and winning the click and converting that click into sales. So back then with those puppy training pads, it was all to do with the amount of pulp inside of the pad, so how much moisture or how much liquid it could absorb. But then the more you put in, the more cost there was to producing the product. And another learning is that the market will always dictate your price. You don't set your price, the market dictates your price. That's not true in areas like consulting, etc., but especially in commodities and products, etc. So you'd have this ceiling of price, but you'd want to produce the best quality products. You've got to maintain a margin. So you're kind of first principle thinking, how can I deliver a good quality product within margin? And yeah, it was a huge learning curve.
Understood. And again, there it shows the level of detail you need to get into with the products that you're selling, because I think there's definitely a misunderstanding, and it's portrayed by maybe people who have a course to sell for 237 or something like that on Instagram that say, oh, come and do this course and you'll become a successful Amazon FBA. But the level of detail you were getting into in terms of the quality of the product needs to be this. If I add X percentage of pulp, then it's going to reduce my margin by Y percentage. Is the juice worth the squeeze, or are we going to lower our volume to an extent that it's no longer sustainable? And I find that intriguing. So if that was one of the kind of starter products, what kind of products stood out along the way that have maybe played big milestone roles within the journey for yourself?
I think people always ask me kind of, what is it you sell? What product should I sell? In today's world, we're in pretty much every category you can think of. We're in home and kitchen, sports and outdoors, automotive. We even have some textiles at this point, which I advise against because of the sizing and everything that comes with it. But effectively, no matter what the product is, it's understanding, one, is there enough demand for it? Two, what's the depth of demand? If there's only one or two different search phrases or keywords that what you enter in the search box for that product, there's going to be a lot of people competing for those one or two terms. Whereas if you find a product that's got 200, 300 highly relevant keywords, then there's more traffic to go around. There's more playground to run in. So is there enough depth? And then it's about understanding kind of what does the market want and how can I improve this product? Now, back then it was simply a case of Alibaba, buy a high quality product, put a logo on it. That does not work anymore. That kind of private label business model is dead. It really now has become product design and product differentiation. So we have a whole team of product designers that we go from research to concept to kind of hand-drawn designs to molding to fully bespoke product design at this point. But yeah, to give examples, chopping boards, I think, I'm just trying to think of ones that have really hit well over the years. We did $1 million in chopping boards 1 month, just up to Christmas, which was interesting. We've done, talked about pads, what else, bed sheets, just everyday products, everyday household items. And then you get into the more luxury stuff as well, but that's lower volume. So everyone thinks there's some sort of magic sauce to this. There really isn't. There's just a formula to doing your research ahead of time, as I said right at the start of this conversation, understanding kind of what's your model. It's kind of like investing, I guess, isn't it? Because you are investing time and money into this. What's your model or what's your criteria? And then going down that kind of differentiation route to make sure you produce a high quality product with the correct margin that's really serving the customer.
What do you think sellers most commonly get wrong?
Great question. The most common thing sellers do is think they're selling to everyone. So they will take a generic product off Alibaba.com that looks the same as every other product in the market. They'll skip the differentiation stage of doing the research, designing something unique. It might even just be a pattern or something simple that's just a print change, but they'll skip that part. They'll put some mediocre listing up that says it's for your mum, for your dog, for your brother, for your auntie. And then they'll click a button on one of these off-the-shelf softwares, download 1,000 keywords, and try and target them all with everything without understanding who they're selling to, the audience, why they're using it, the use case, and then more specifically, the intent in the search. Often of 20,000 keywords, there's probably only 200 there that are actually relevant to the intent of the audience that you're serving. So I think the mistake, to kind of put a fine point on it, is not getting specific on who it is you're selling to and why they're using that product.
Understood. And one of the things that, when I was doing my research about Amazon, is some sellers are trying to optimize for different things. They're trying to optimize for high number of ratings or reviews. They're trying to be high up the BSR, which is the best sellers rank.
Yeah.
Which of these are important, and which should maybe somebody... We're talking about energy there in terms of assigning it within your business, and you were kind of almost feeling like you were assigning too much energy to a previous business. Which of these kind of metrics should people put their energy towards?
So the thing you've got to understand about Amazon is it's a conversion-driven platform, and there isn't a single cog that generates the results. There's four or five key cogs that one turns the other and then creates this flywheel effect. So if you take a conversion-first mindset, you win or lose on Amazon in the buying, not the selling. You've won or lost by the time you've ordered your product. If you do that correctly and you understand who you're selling to and kind of what they care about, and you develop that product correctly, and you've validated there's a market for that product, which is all the stuff we teach in Titan, by the time you get it to Amazon, then it's a case of just focusing and spending money wisely on advertising. But if you were to focus on conversion, it's quality of product being first and foremost. After quality of products and understanding who it is you're selling to, it's your keyword research, targeting the right keywords, producing a high quality listing, so photos, videos now. I mean, Amazon's going big into video. Writing the listing copy in the language of your customer, speaking to them specifically, benefit-led, what's it going to do for them? When someone's buying a drill, they're not buying a drill, they're buying a hole. What benefit of drilling that hole are they going to get? And then it's all about reviews and driving kind of conversion via reviews, and then enforcing that with visibility with advertising.
It used to be quite easy to gamify Amazon. I see people talking about, oh, number one bestseller in this particular category for books. Now, of course, with products and commodities, it is a little bit different, and there is an element of volume. But how can people maybe drive reviews without falling foul of some of the tripwires they might fall into? Because I know, for example, for the podcast, this episode will get X number of thousand listens, but my total number of reviews on the platform is about 500 across Spotify and Apple Podcasts. Now, don't get me wrong, that's going up the way, and for a show of the size that I've got, that's actually quite good, because some of the huge shows have got like 1,000 reviews, but I know they're getting millions of downloads. So people taking the time to hover their finger and hit a review and type a thing can sometimes be a little bit of inertia. So what's maybe a way that you can incentivize that?
Yeah, sure. So I think depending on the platform, and I'll speak to Amazon specifically, but every platform has terms of service, and they'll have very kind of clear guidelines. Some are looser than others. Five years ago, 10 years ago on Amazon, it was the Wild West. I mean, 10 years ago, you could literally buy reviews and have them put on. But Amazon's definitely locked down on all of that, because if you think about what Amazon's promise is, it's that you can trust it. The reason that I think 70% of online spending in the US is now spent on Amazon.com, which is, it used to be 50%, one in $2, but now it's 70% of online spending. The reason that's happening, not only is it the convenience, but all of those factors, if you were summarizing, it's trust, isn't it? You trust Amazon. You trust that the reviews are accurate and the product is accurately described. You trust that it's going to show up same day or next day. You trust that if you have a problem, you can return it. So, for Amazon to maintain that trust, in the last 2 years, they've come down very, very hard on any level of review manipulation. So now everything that is done is just all about delivering a good experience. So the way in which we translate that tactically on Amazon, one, customer service. Our customer service reps are trained and incentivized to go above and beyond to deliver the best result. If someone's not happy, we send a free product. We have sub 1 hour response times, 24 hours a day. We just deliver a fantastic experience. And one thing you'll see in our reviews is often comments around the customer service. We had a review the other day on one of our products that says, great product, even better customer service. And that's what I want to see. And every time we see something like that, we reward the agent that worked on it with a $5 bonus for every mention of good customer service. So that's step one. Amazon has also gone a long way to helping the third-party brand owner generate reviews in an ethical way. So they have the review follow-up tool. So every order, you can kind of configure this. And we've got software in Titan that we've spent a few years building now that kind of automates all this stuff. But in Amazon on the dashboard, you've got a button where you can click request a review. They get an email from Amazon and they can leave a review. And then where we've got to, we used to do a lot of product inserts. Now you can still do manufacturer's inserts and we definitely do that. But you have to be very careful about what you include on that insert within their terms of service. But a big one that we do is something called an unexpected gift. So they've bought a product, they're expecting one thing, they open up that box and there's something else in there as well. And it just creates that kind of warm, fuzzy feeling. And I think for anyone selling on Amazon that kind of is thinking about reviews and how do I increase them, it all comes back to branding. A brand isn't just a logo. A brand is how you make your customer feel. And if you go above and beyond to deliver that kind of almost like Apple-like experience when they unbox and when they open that product and you track your review rate, so your reviews per 100 orders, you're just going to see it go in one direction. So that's kind of how it works on Amazon as a platform. For a podcast and for other ones, I'm sure there's lots of ways of properly incentivizing with various competitions, etc. But that's kind of how it is on Amazon.
In terms of business advice there, that's I know people pay so much money to get access to that, Dan. So thank you for sharing that. And there's now more money in Amazon than ever before in terms of both being spent by consumers. You were mentioning there 70% of the money spent online in the US, which is just a colossal figure. And people just gravitate towards it. And I think the C19 period played a big role in that as well, because my parents now in their late 60s, early 70s, both just gravitate to Amazon. They pay for Prime because they know it's going to come reliably the next day. And Amazon has done terrific work around just how quick they can turn things around that makes it so much more convenient than anything else. But not only is more money being spent by the consumer, but there's also a lot of Wall Street investment as well. And that has changed the nature of maybe what some people set out to do within the platform as well. How do you feel about all that Wall Street money coming into the platform?
Yeah, sure. It's been an interesting journey to watch, actually, because I kind of consider this industry having been through maybe four or five different chapters, and I've been around for all of them. You kind of had the early days of the first adopters. I was kind of in the last piece of that chapter. Then you had kind of the systemized chapter of us figuring out all the different tactics and hacks to deliver results. Then you had this early kind of institutional money chapter that attempted to come in and buy these brands. It didn't really work. Then you had the big boom, which you're talking about, where $16 billion was poured into this industry in 2.5 years. And what it was, just to kind of summarize the point, was a bunch of private equity money and Wall Street money coming in, seeing these very under-optimized, under-sophisticated businesses with respectfully under-sophisticated business owners running them, small business owners, solopreneurs, who didn't really understand cash flow management. They didn't understand institutional kind of supply chain management, contract shipping. They didn't have boots on the ground in China that could go drive better payment terms or better COGS. And they didn't have distribution off Amazon, where if they plug that same product into five other distribution channels, they could 10x the business. So these PE firms came in and thought, well, if we buy this brand that evidently has its own profit and cash flow on Amazon as a platform, and maintain or grow that, and then later down the line, we might be able to go into retail and all the stuff that big business do. It was great for the first and second generation of sellers because it made a bunch of millionaires overnight. You could take a business that was doing maybe $1 million in earnings in profit and sell that business for its peak 5 or 6 times. So I've got friends that built a business in 18 months and sold it 5 or 6 million. I've got other friends that work with me in Titan who sold it for north of 10 million. And there was just so much money sloshing around the industry. And it was a really...
As a multiple, that's huge, isn't it? Because some businesses sell for a fraction of that multiple in terms of the revenue and
the
turnover.
Yeah, it's definitely come down to normalize now. Like the average right now is kind of 2 to 3x. And I think that's where now it will stabilize. And that's kind of set the market. So it's an amazing thing from a wealth creation point of view from the entrepreneurs that are in the industry. It also brought a lot of professional service to the industry. It institutionalized the industry from a point of going from like a bedroom industry to like a professional industry. I don't know if that makes sense. Like the conferences went from a bunch of people like me in t-shirts and shorts, kind of just becoming friends and having drinks, to all of a sudden suits turning up and all these kind of service providers showing up. And don't get me wrong, they caught on soon and ditched the suits and put the shorts on. But yeah, it kind of professionalized the industry. But then what's happened now is it kind of created a vacuum, because the successful sellers were bought out. Said platforms or aggregators, as they're known, soon realized that these are very guerrilla marketing businesses, and you can't put a web designer in. You can't remove the founder, put a web designer in and say, hey, generate the same result that entrepreneur generated. It just doesn't work. Unfortunately, I think a lot of them also got caught with inflation pricing and COVID. So you mentioned COVID, as well as there being more spending, prices went through the roof. So you're buying these businesses that have inflated earnings through inflated pricing and inflated consumer demand. COVID disappears, the pandemic disappears, pricing comes down, consumer demand normalizes back to its original state, and you've overpaid for these businesses. So there's been a bunch of learnings. And then unfortunately, as a result of that, a lot of the entrepreneurs that did sell out, the deal structures would typically be like 70% cash up front, 30% earn out over 2 years, maybe. So a deferred payment. Many of them didn't get that deferred payment because the buyers, the operators, these big Wall Street type companies weren't able to actually operate the businesses. And many of the businesses just kind of nosedived off a cliff. So definitely good and bad, lots of learnings, but they're definitely learnings that have, for the greater good, have accelerated the knowledge of everyone in the industry, including myself, and some of the stuff we're now doing in Titan, where we have Titan Integrator, which is, you could kind of liken it's like a Y incubator, where we partner with our members, we acquire the business, we partner with them for 2 years, and we throw resource and capital at it, so people and capital at the business, and just accelerate growth. And if it wasn't for kind of the big Wall Street money coming in for a couple of years and me sitting here observing it and kind of seeing the good, the bad, the ugly, and then applying those learnings to what we're doing, we wouldn't be so strong at what we're doing now, where we're rolling up effectively hundreds of businesses into a single platform.
Of course, but from you having watched with a keen eye and implemented, that gives you a tremendous advantage, whereas some people in the industry maybe just watched from afar and went, oh, doesn't interest me, or, oh, well, maybe I can exit really quickly. And that's great for some of the people that have done that. But like you say, there's clauses in those that mean that if you don't sell it in the best possible position, you maybe don't get the full exit. But it is exciting that somebody can build a business very quickly, 1 year, 2 years, and then sell for a large exit. And I think in that space, it is almost a little bit of a wealth fountain. Like if you look at it as an event, you can create something very quickly, because how many other businesses can scale to that revenue that quickly, because of the money being spent on the platform and applying themselves in the right possible way, and then exit for a high, like a relatively high valuation and generate that money and maybe go do something else if Amazon isn't something you want to do in the longer term. So is from that perspective, it's such an exciting industry to be in.
I can't name another business, coming back to economic engine and vehicle, I can't name another vehicle of business that is able to generate profit sustainably, that's as scalable as this is, that has the least startup costs, no infrastructure, that you can then sell for a 2 to 3 times earnings profit in 2 to 3 years. Like, name another business that has that ability. You can be location independent. You can get started with 10 or 20 grand nowadays. Anyone that tells you can start with $500, it's a load of bollocks. But you can start with 10 or 20 grand properly. You can scale that thing up to $1 million or £1 million in earnings in a couple of years, and then you can sell that for 2 or 3 million. Like, name another business that allows you to do that in such a short amount of time on a platform that is growing faster than anything else in the world and is acquiring so much revenue. I mean, I read an article in Bloomberg this week that Amazon is considering giving free cell phone service to Prime users.
wild when you consider the perks. It is mad how much they can just package in, because while people talk about Prime for the delivery, you also get the movies, you get the access to the TV, and then they sign things exclusively. So I think they had like the autumn test for the international rugby last year, and they stole that from Sky, like and BBC and whoever else. So there's significant investment in perks within the platform. Within Titan Network, one of the questions I wanted to ask you was, what core skill do you teach on to new sellers or sellers that are looking to level up that you personally wish you knew earlier?
Less is more. Sophistication is not what I can add to something or what can I do more of. Sophistication is what can I strip away but still generate the same result, or what's the path of least resistance to that result. So what Titan essentially stands for is continual refinement of a playbook to generate a result. And we're very fortunate, because unlike most of kind of the gurus that you see on social media selling courses and stuff, we've got over 1,000 sellers that are part of a community that's very like-minded, has high trust for each other. I mean, we're all friends at this point. We travel all over the world together. We have two major events a year. There's true relationship, and everyone is feeding back into what we call the Titan way. And this is a playbook, a framework for generating success on Amazon. And it's not when at each stage of the journey, you have you yourself as the entrepreneur and your business maturity has different needs, and there's different things that you should be doing each stage. So really the focal point within Titan is it's kind of the one thing, like what is that one thing that you need to do now that takes you to the next step and makes everything else easier. And it's really a point of refinement. Like, you don't need to do everything. There's 3 or 4 core things that you need to do and do well. Go really deep on those, and you'll generate the result. And you mentioned something earlier that I'm a massive believer in, and that's that success leaves clues. Everyone thinks that you've got to figure it all out yourself. In everything I've been very successful at, I've always, and I reflected on this the other day, I've always found someone that's achieved the exact result I'm trying to achieve. And then I've, in any which way I can, broken down how they did it, whether I've paid them to learn from them, or I've made sure I'm in the same room as them and I can buy them a beer and have a conversation. I've always gone for a proven framework that has generated the exact result. And where I've failed generally is where I've tried something like I put $100,000, it wasn't all my money either, into an app called Hello Taxi. Got 2,000 taxi companies in the UK, and then Uber came out to the private sector and killed us. Failures like that are where I've just completely gone unguided and tried to figure it out. So the real specific point that we push within Titan is predictable, repeatable success in a proven framework, focusing on what you need to do right now and put the blinkers on and forget everything else.
It's so easy to get distracted. Shiny object syndrome is an absolute killer of so many different entrepreneurs and so many different individuals. And I was going to ask you about the taxi company as well, because I think from what I've learned over the last 3 years interviewing so many different people is that quite often there's like the one that got away, or there's like a moment where, like, particularly for entrepreneurs, as you said, you cannot do everything. And sometimes you have to let something go that maybe felt, oh, wow, I think I could really do something here. So yeah, that maybe stands out as one that got away, because if you'd done it on the same framework as Uber, perhaps it would have been the British Uber.
I think that comes back to who, not what. So that's another thing I've kind of learned in my journey is you can't do everything yourself. Like I still own multiple businesses. Obviously, Amazon is my main thing, but I've always partnered with the who that I need to help me achieve the result that has the strengths that I don't have, or has an ability that I don't have. And in the taxi thing, looking back, I mean, we were really onto something. We were 2 years ahead of anyone. We had 2,000 taxi companies across the UK signed up, and that was a big recruitment thing in itself. But I attempted to bootstrap the whole thing, develop out of overseas. Had I had the experience I had today and known proper infrastructure, proper planning, proper funding, gone out and properly funded the project, I'm pretty sure that would have been a 9-figure success. But yeah, it's that I take that learning through today. And I mentioned Titan Integrator and what we're doing there. You apply that learning to what we're doing today there, and it's great. I've got the institutional backing. I've got the right people on the board. I've got, so I think you just, like I say, success leaves clues, and it's just about kind of having the ability to pick those clues up and apply them.
Huge points. Second last question for you, Dan. You've moved back to the UK to pursue things that you really feel you want to do because you were feeling a little bit too comfortable out in Dubai. What are some of those big things that you're going to be pursuing?
Good question. So yeah, we're only really just getting started with Titan. The first iteration of Titan, it's 4 years old now, which is crazy. I just don't know where the time's gone. So we're leveling up Titan in the way in which we help people succeed on Amazon. We're effectively breaking up the community into sub-communities, back to that point of let's help people with what they need at that moment in time, and let's not overwhelm with all this other stuff. So network's undergoing a huge kind of enhancement. And then all of my focus is on the future of Titan Integrator. So we've come up with a model that allows the entrepreneur to win. So whereas if you think about the conversation we just had about the 16 billion coming into the space and Wall Street pouring all that in, or private equity pouring all that in, typically it's the big money winning. Don't be wrong, it's making the individual a millionaire, but the upside is going to the aggregate of the money. So we've spent 2 years designing a model that effectively allows us to take what would typically be a two or three times earnings on a valuation, and through a partnership model and accelerating growth through my team that's 220 people now, 230 people, and accelerating with capital, we can take that same business and generate a result for the individual that's maybe three times that. So like a 6 or 7 or 8 overall value, some of them going double digits in value. So I'm just really excited about that because it's everything we stand for. Together we're stronger. Bring the entrepreneurs together. 1 + 1 = 3. Deploy the best team with passion and compassion. And then at the end of the result, we all win together on the exit.
And it also links into that piece about you feeling a passion for teaching on to others to reinforce the different lessons that you've learned. So it ties up nicely, Dan.
Yeah, I'm excited, man. So we're 6 months into it. We're already well ahead of our vision. And over the next 3 years, our goal is to build a company that has the potential to be valued at $1 billion.
Yeah, huge goals to work towards. And I'm sure the listeners like myself have enjoyed the conversation. If they want to continue the conversation with you, Dan, where should they head towards?
Check out Instagram, Dan Ashburn UK, or titannetwork.com.
That'll be linked in the show notes. Thank you so much, Dan. And thank you to the listener. I'll be back to speak to you all again very, very soon.